Thank you for visiting RayMayhewOnline.com. You're listening to an audio resource by Ray Mayhew.
This is Assyria is just ending here, just squeezed on. And it was Assyria that took the north, the 10 tribes, into captivity. That was in 722. And then the empire of Babylon arose, and they took Judah into captivity in 586. And this is the period when the land is empty for 70 years. Then in 538, Babylon fell, and the kingdom of Persia arose, and Cyrus allowed the Jews to return. However, not many did, but he allowed them to return. And so we have some Jews back in the land, but most are still in Babylon. And this is the period right here where we get Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. And Esther will come, so we get the Persian Empire, here's Nehemiah coming back a little later on, and then Persia falls, we get Greece falls, and we get Rome, and the birth of our Lord. So just to give you a little outline. And then there were some questions about the period last week, so I did a little bit more research as my knowledge of the Persian Empire is not great. And there were two Xerxes, and there were three Artaxerxes. So these all get a little bit mixed up. And Xerxes the First, there's a nice picture of him. He looks so fierce, I don't know that I would like to come before him uninvited. But here's Xerxes the First, and he was the son of Darius, and he was a descendant, either grandfather or great-grandfather, of the Cyrus who allowed the Jews to go back into the land. He succeeded his father in 486, to give you the timeline here. The Battle of Thermopylae, which all of you learnt about in school, was in 480 BC. Somebody asked me last week, was this Xerxes the Persian who organized the Battle of Thermopylae? And I said, I thought it was one after him, but it indeed was Xerxes the First. Haman asked for the decree to kill the Jews in the 12th year of the reign of Xerxes. So that would put it about 474. Esther had been on the throne about 4 years. So she came on the throne about 478. I think I said 480 last week, but the dates aren't definite. I mentioned that. Now, here's the little tricky part, and I won't spend much time on it. Some think that the events in Esther took place in the reign of his son Artaxerxes, which would have put it all at a later date. However, it gets even more complicated because Herodotus, who's the historian of the period, says it was Xerxes, just like we've been saying. However, in the Septuagint and Josephus, they say in Esther it was Artaxerxes. And so it's not definite, and it's not actually important to the story. But there were some questions coming last week, and so I just wanted to clear those up. Now, let's turn to Esther chapter 3, and we're going to read right along here. I'm going to make some comments as we go, Esther 3, and then I'll put up some notes, and I apologize that you don't have my notes this week. You do have the notes from last week, and they're coming a little late. But anyways, Esther 3, and I'll start reading from my kind of eclectic version, and you can follow along in your own Bible. Okay, Esther 3, verse 1. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. Now, he now commanded the royal guard, the guard that guarded Xerxes the Great. He commanded the royal guard, and he was the one who controlled who had an audience with the king. Very, very powerful position. Verse 2. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke with him because they knew the consequences, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated. Now we'll find out that Haman knew all about it and he was already furious. But anyway, they told whether his behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And you see, he might kneel before the king, okay, because he knew that Xerxes would not receive that as worship. But Haman, when you knelt before him, he would just receive that as worship. And as a Jew, Mordecai could not and would not do that. Verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, of course they were the Jews, the ancient enemy of the Amalekites, and Haman was an Agagite, descended from the Amalekites, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes, stretching from all the way from India to Ethiopia. And this would be genocide, nothing short of genocide. Verse 7, in the 12th year of Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Now, there's rather an interesting thing here. This is our calendar, you remember. It's the Jewish calendar. We said last week that there was a sacred and a civic calendar. And so they started casting lots in the month of Nisan. And it says in the NIV that as they look for a propitious day, it came out to be in the month of Adar. However, there's another translation for that verse, which is even more devastating, and it reads like this. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Artaxerxes, pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. In other words, this was so important, this was going to be huge, a genocide of a people scattered from India to to Ethiopia, and they were all, and so, and of course, they were all into astrology, that it was terribly important to them that they got this right. And so they actually took a year working with the astrologers to find an auspicious day and month to carry this out. And so this was a very, they knew this was a very serious thing. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among all the provinces of your kingdom." Notice that. All the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all other people, and who do not obey the king's laws, which was not true. That was a lie. And it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. And so Haman suggests, he doesn't name them, that this ethnic group would be likely to revolt against the king. And he says they'll destabilize the empire. And that's what's happening in India today. That's what's happening in India today. And when we had the BJP in power, they were saying that Christians who are multiplying in India would destabilize the nation. And thank God that last week, you remember, the Congress Party got back into power in India. And that's why in the state of Orissa, they were murdering Christians. And if you paid $250, you could get a pastor murdered in the state of Orissa. And of course, they used the argument that Christians would destabilize the nation. The same thing that Haman is saying. Whereas in fact, Christians are always the best citizens because they pray for the welfare of the nation. Verse 9, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver, 33 tons of silver. Can you imagine that? I will put 33 tons of silver. This was the superpower of the day, and even Haman, second to the king, had this kind of wealth. 33 tons of silver into the treasury, into the royal treasury, for the men who carry out this business. Verse 10, so the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Notice, the enemy of the Jews. And verse 11, keep the money, the king said to Haman. Now that's not a good translation. It should read more like this. The silver's yours, do with it as you suggest. Not keep it, but do with it as you suggest. And with the people, as you please. And he doesn't even know who they are, and that his grandfather gave great favor to these people. So he says, just do as you please. Now what's interesting is verse 12. Then on the 13th day of the first month, the month of Nisan, the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. And they wrote the decree on the 13th of Nisan. So on the 14th of Nisan, it would have begun to have been distributed throughout the empire. And does anybody remember what happens on the 14th of Nisan? It is what feast? It's Passover. So on the days when the Jews are celebrating their great deliverance from genocide in the land of Egypt, now this edict is going out on that very day to say there will be another genocide. And God overrules. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. And that decree is going out on the very day they're remembering their deliverance from genocide in Egypt. Now there's going to be a genocide in Persia. And what's God saying? He's saying he delivered you once, he can deliver you again. That's what the Lord is saying. And that's true of our lives. And often we forget, don't we? We run into a crisis, it's a financial crisis, but we forget what God has done for us time and time and time before. And we need to remember. And that's why they had the feasts. And then verse 13, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces. You remember they had this system. It was the fastest system in the world of relays of horses that would travel day and night. And so to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate. Now, wouldn't it be enough to say destroy? No, it's destroy, kill, wouldn't that be enough? And annihilate the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, that was Adar. So they would have 12 months to get the edict out, to organize local garrisons, etc., for the destruction of the Jews and to plunder their decree. Verse 14, a copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. Verse 15, spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered because they know the Jews are not a rebellious people and that they had, most of them had chosen to live there. And Jeremiah said, he said, build houses, marry, and pray for the welfare of this people. And that's why they were bewildered. And now what I want to say before moving on is we find a pattern here that is repeated all the way through Scripture. And it's simply that Satan, you'll find, is always seeking to destroy the seed through which the Messiah will come. Okay, so Abel is murdered by Cain, and Abel would have been the one to carry the seed, and he is murdered. This is Genesis 6. The sons of God, it says, go in. I should have written to the daughters of men. Now, we don't know if this was natural or supernatural. The Jews thought it was supernatural, sons of God usually being angels, in this case fallen angels, but it could have been the descendants of Seth. We don't know. They went into the daughters of men, but there was some sort of tampering with the seed. This we know. Some sort of corrupting of the seed. And that led to the flood. It was so serious because God was determined to rescue the world, bring in a redeemer. Then the wives of the patriarchs. Now this is remarkable. Okay. Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, the wives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they can't conceive for years and years. Why is it? It's because the enemy does not want the seed propagated, the seed of the Messiah taken forward. And so we move on, and the Egyptians kill all the male children. Why is it a demonic attack on the seed? We move forward. And now Haman is seeking to annihilate the seed. We move forward, and Herod murders all the children. Why? Because Satan does not want the seed of the Messiah to be birthed. He does not want. He came to, you remember, it says in John, to kill, to murder, and to destroy. And Haman's doing the same thing. Herod's doing the same thing. And then the Jews execute Jesus. Now we're going to come back to this. Why? Well, of course, we know behind it was a demonic plot. It even says that Satan entered Judas. Okay, the Jews execute you. Now, of course, they didn't know what they were doing, but the forces of darkness thought that they could destroy now. They could destroy the purposes of God. And then we find this summed up in Revelation. This whole history going right back to Cain and Abel. And what we read there is a great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. Now, the events are happening on earth, but in heaven you see the spiritual realities lying behind them. A woman, Israel is always a woman in the Old Testament, clothed with the sun, that means she has authority, with the moon under her feet, that means she's beautiful, and a crown of 12 stars, the 12 tribes, on her head. And she was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven. Things were happening on the earth, but their spiritual reality is seen in heaven. An enormous red dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns. In other words, a plenitude of power. Okay? And the dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth to the seed, so that he might devour her child, her seed, the moment it was born. And this is what's been happening since Abel all the way through. And the dragon stood in front of... Oh, I read that, okay. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And that is why, because Satan knows that his rule will be replaced, that he seeks to destroy the seed. And that's happening all the way through. Now, just one little window before I read on. Excuse my very ragged diagram here, but I'll kind of get it up. Can you see that? Okay, this was the period that I put up on the board at the start of the class. And Israel goes out of the land in 586, okay? And for 70 years, okay, the 70 years is actually 516. That's measured to when they rebuilt the temple. But a few started to come back, 50,000, in 538. But this is the period where the land in which the seed must be born, must be planted, as it were, is empty. It's empty. There's a vacuum. And in that 70-year period, you'll find that we have the rise of Buddhism, Confucianism, Jainism. If you've ever been in India or seen it, on the movies, you'll always know if somebody belongs to Jainism because they wear a little mask. Does anybody know why they wear a little mask when they're out? It's so because they won't kill any living creature. They try not to step on ants or anything else, and they wear a little mask so they won't inhale a little gnat or anything. Jainism, Zoroastrianism, which is in Persia now at this time, Taoism, and a version of Hinduism called Upanishadic Hinduism. Hinduism is kind of not just one thing. And so all the alternative seeds, as it were, which are still with us today, these are all with us today, they arose. This is extraordinary. You think of world history, 4,000 years since Abraham, and all these arose in this period when there was a vacuum. Because if there's a vacuum, it's like the enemy rushes in to fill it with, almost seed the earth with false seed. And so they arise in this period, which actually secular historians call the Axial Age, because it was a great axis in the history of the world. They can't understand why these all arose in such a short period of time. But we do. We know what was going on supernaturally behind the scenes. And so it's a very, very remarkable thing. And it dovetails here into the book of Esther. Right, now I'm going to continue to move right on and read, because now things begin to warm up and the plot begins to thicken. And so follow along in your Bible, chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and often the sackcloth was just a loincloth, because it was, and to put on ashes was like saying, I am already dead, I am already dead, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. And the dust was, I'm already buried. It was kind of a dramatic statement. Verse 2, but he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it, that's enter the palace. And so victims of injustice would stand at the king's gate, and they would cry out for justice and for the king to vindicate them. And that's what Mordecai is doing, but with no effect. Verse 3, in every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Notice, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. And many lay in sackcloth and ashes. But Esther had no idea what was going on. And so she sends a message to Mordecai. And we pick it up in verse 8. And Mordecai gave him, that's the eunuch who Esther sent, a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and to explain it to her. And he told him, that's the eunuch, to urge Esther to go into the king's presence, to beg for mercy, and to plead with him for her people. And so the eunuch goes back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. And she sends back a message, and you'll remember this. And what does she say? What does she say to him? What does she say to Mordecai? She says, I can't go into the king. If anybody goes into the king without being invited, it's a death sentence. You couldn't simply go into the king. You had to go through this whole protocol, which was controlled by Haman, and so Esther couldn't tell Haman what she wanted to see the king for. And so, verse 11, the only exception for this is for the king to extend the golden scepter, notice, to him, and spare his life. It was unthinkable that a woman would do this. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go into the king. Because the queen didn't sleep with the king normally, just occasionally. He had all his concubines, his porcupines, whatever. And so she didn't eat with him, had her separate quarters. Verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. Now, this is not a threat. This is just what will happen. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. He knows. He knows. Now, it's just been Passover. He knows that the Jews can't be destroyed. However, perhaps 95% of them might be annihilated. But he knows God's purposes can't be totally thwarted. But the fact that he says to Esther, but you and your father's family will perish, is simply because perhaps, as I say, 95% will die. And so Esther, don't think that even being a Jew in the king's household gives you safety. And he knows that deliverance will arise by another means. And then the end of verse 14, that lovely verse, which we all know, and who knows but that you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And I'll have more to say about this in a minute. Verse 15, then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. And fast for me. That's why we're having a season of fasting now in the church. Fasting of prayer for the nations. Do not eat or drink. A fast in the ancient world, you neither ate nor did you drink. Do not eat and drink for 3 days or 3 nights. And I and my maids will fast as you do. And when this is done, the end of verse 16, I will go into the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And sometimes to do the will of God and to extend the kingdom, okay, we have come to the kingdom for such a time as this, and we have to at times take risks for the kingdom. And that's why that when you got to about the year 295 AD, about 310,000 Christians had laid down their lives for the gospel, because Christianity was illegal. But they knew they'd come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And we benefit. We're the beneficiaries of their witness. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. Now just a few things, and then we'll get to where the plot really, really gets interesting and amazing. This is an amazing book. Now, obviously, there's lots of symbolism going on here. But I want to show here the synergy of God and the church working together to, you see, God is doing his work. You remember that edict is going out on the very day of Passover. God is doing his work, ruling and overruling, but he needs Esther's and Mordecai's to work with him. And that, of course, is the church. Now, God does not speak prophetically. I said this last week in this book. This is perhaps the great crisis in the Old Testament. But the name God does not appear in the book, as I said last week. However, many think that Yahweh, when you wrote Hebrew, you didn't use any vowels. So that's Yahweh for the tetragram, the four sacred letters, is found as an acrostic four times in the text. The first letters of the first four words in 120 and 5:4, and the last letters of the last four words in 5:13 and 7:7. Now, this could be a coincidence, but either way, we know that God is working behind the scenes. So, as I've said, if God is silent in your life, if God doesn't seem to be speaking and you're in a crisis, don't think he's not working. That's what we go through those periods. We think, it's a crisis and I don't have any word from God. Well, if you don't have a word, don't think God's not at work, because he was powerfully at work behind the scenes, and he is in our lives. And he has people in position ahead of the crisis. As with Joseph, the great crisis in Egypt. As with Daniel, the great crisis in Babylon. And Esther is in the palace already. He has his people. He knows the crisis is coming. He has his people in place already. Esther in the palace, Mordecai in the gate, the midwives in Egypt. You remember that story, the midwives in Egypt. Rahab is in Jericho. He has his people in place ahead of time. And he will overthrow fate and determinism. And it's astonishing how even in this kind of scientific age, fate and determinism grip so many people. Yeah, I grew up in England. It was not a very Christian country at that time. And I can remember people who had been in the war saying, well, you know, if the bullet had my name on it, you know, I'd have died. Well, what kind of, that is so pagan. You see, it's fatalistic. It's determinism. And you see, what they're trying to do for 12 months in casting the pur, in casting the die or the lot, is that there was great astrology in Persia. They spent as much time looking at the sky as we spend looking at TV. That was just the way it was. They were totally into astrology. And of course, astrology is all about fate and determinism. And of course, in every... how many newspapers have the your astrology for the day? I mean, they're all over the place. They're all over the place. But that's just the... in my family growing up, you know, we'd read it every day. I mean, often we'd laugh about it, but it was there every day. But this is just the thin end of what astrology is. Astrology, when you get deep into it, is a very, very wicked system that determines your life. And I can remember a woman coming to me for counseling who had been deeply into astrology, and she said, I'm terrified. Now, she had become a Christian. She said, because every major event that has happened in my life was forecast by the astrological charts, not just these things in the newspaper. And it said, it even said that I would become a Christian. Now, the devil doesn't mind, okay, saying you that if he's going to terrify you. And she was terrified. And I had to explain to her that that was broken. That was broken when she came to Jesus. That was broken when she was baptized. And it freed her, but it's a terrifying thing. And so this is kind of serious. This is kind of serious stuff. And it's demonic. It denies the power of prayer. And it distorts the sovereignty of God. And I can remember a friend of mine who worked in Yemen. And there was a Muslim woman who could not conceive. Now, this was not just because she had been married, you know, for a few years. She could not conceive. And they prayed for her, and she conceived, and she gave birth to a child. And they said to her, isn't Jesus wonderful? She's a Muslim. Isn't Jesus wonderful? He's answered our prayers. And she just said, well, if Allah wants me to have a baby, I'll have a baby. If Allah doesn't want me to have a baby, I won't have a baby. You see, that's fatalism, and it's the opposite. It's the opposite of what we believe. The by prayer and fasting, that's why they're praying and fasting, things can be changed. Amen? Amen? And they can be. And they can be. And so that's what's going on here. God will overthrow fate and determinism. And of course, he gives us access into his presence. And you know well the symbolism that's going on here. Nobody can go into the king. Nobody can go into the king without authority. And you'll remember the picture. There's an obvious symbolism here. I'll put up the next sheet, Jenny. You can help me here. There's an obvious symbolism here. Because you remember in Israel, here was the temple. Okay, here was the tabernacle, or if this was the outer court, and the people could come in here, the priests could come in here, but into the presence of God, only one man on the planet, only one man on the planet, on one day of the year, the Day of Atonement, could go into the presence of God. And of course, and if he did, they said he would die. And even when the high priest went in, they would tie a rope around his ankle So if he died in the presence of God, they could pull him back out without having to go in and also die. Now, of course, that's not the nature and character of God. But you see, the only exception was for the king to extend his golden scepter. And of course, in Jesus, God extends his scepter, and we can approach the throne with boldness. And now, you remember, it's not a throne of judgments. It's a throne of, let us come boldly before the throne of grace. That's right, grace. And you know, we do not do this. We do not do this. When people, so many people, when they pray, you can hear it in their voices. What they're thinking about when they pray is, I haven't lived very well this week. You know, I had this bad argument on Thursday with my wife. And, you know, I've not been, you know, really following these 10 days of global prayer and whatever. And when we go into the presence of God, now, if you were a Jew, what you would be realizing is that the veil had been torn and you could go right in. You'd have forgotten about yourself because this was so astonishing. But you see, we reverse it and we're looking inward when we should be looking outward and seeing we have an invitation to go where only one man on the planet could go for one brief, probably half hour, one day a year. And we have access into our Father's presence whenever we want. And then the church, and again, we could deal with this symbolism for a long, long time. We are a bride, and we'll find that Esther is given oil, myrrh, and spices to purify herself to enter the presence of the king. And we're in a time when we're being purified. We're being sanctified. And this is why the Catholics, how many of you grew up as Catholics in the room? Quite a few. And they have the doctrine of purgatory. Now, we don't believe in purgatory because it's not in the Bible, but it's quite kind of logical because when they developed the doctrine of purgatory, they thought, well, you know, all these people are not living godly lives, okay? They say they're following Jesus, but they're not living godly lives, okay? They say they're Christians, but they're not. Well, how can they go after they die into the presence of the holy God? You see, God can't wave a wand and make you holy. Otherwise, he would now. Okay? So they said, well, there had to be a kind of holding pen after you died, before you went to heaven. And we don't believe there is. Okay? So we are being purified. But God's plan is that you get purified now. You get purified now. And we are scattered among the nations. Scattered among the nations. Now, this is going to be very interesting, and I'm going to come back to it in a moment. But it says in chapter 3, verse 14, that they were scattered in all the provinces of your kingdom, all 127 provinces. And I put a similar map to this up last week. But this is the territory. Now, this is going to become very interesting because here is Israel in here. And now they're scattered not only into what was Assyria, not was only into what was Babylon, but into Persia. And it says throughout all 127 provinces of the empire of the Persians. That means they were up here in the Balkans. That means they were down here in the Sudan. That means they were in Egypt. That means that they were in Afghanistan. That means they were in India. That means they were wherever this is today. It's one of those Central Asian stans, you know, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, etc., they were up here. They were just all over. Now, this is going to become very Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. They were all over, and we'll come to that in a moment. And now, why? I just finished this off. We're called to be intercessors. I could say so much about that, to come into the presence of God on behalf of our people. And we're called to fast. We're called to fast. Now, why I say this is it says that Esther was fasting, Mordecai was fasting, and the people were fasting throughout the empire because they knew fasting. Okay, now they had to cooperate with God. You see, God doesn't simply work, kind of unilaterally. Of course, he can, but he invites us in to be co-laborers with him. That's why we could have angels simply speaking the gospel, kind of, 20 feet up in the air. But he uses us. He wants to work in cooperation with his people. And Wesley said that we either overemphasize fasting or we underemphasize it. And that is so true. 30 years ago in the evangelical world, nobody talked about fasting. I don't know how many of you were Christians 30 years ago, but nobody talked about fasting. It was simply not done. Now, thank God that fasting has come back into our vocabulary. Now, you see what God is doing behind the scenes. Okay, you can look out on this nation and you can look at same-sex marriage. Okay, you can look at stem cell research. You can look at inner-city violence. You can look at the devastation in the nations, be it Iraq, be it Afghanistan, be it Darfur, etc. And you can say, oh my goodness, what is going on? Pastor Nancy Murdoch, who started this church, said to me about a month ago, they said, America is not what it used to be. And it's not. But here we go. In 30 years, it's kind of gone into moral free fall. But what's happening? Fasting is on our lips. It's come back into the vocabulary of the church. It's becoming more and more common among the people of God around the globe. Should that give us encouragement? Yes, it should, because God is at work behind the scene. And just in this case, we need to cooperate with him. We need to cooperate with him. Okay. I think I need to move on because it gets so good. I just need to keep reading here. We could just really you could really read the Bible at home and not come to this class, and you would get just as much. But anyways, I'm supposed to be here, and you are here. And so I'm going to read chapter 5, which is a very short chapter, and then just say a couple of things before moving on. Chapter 5. Now, compared to this, Hollywood is boring, okay? Compared to this stuff, Hollywood is boring, okay? And I'm sure that there's going to be a blockbuster movie come out sometime on the Book of Esther. But nope, sorry. There is already, okay. Well, it's not good enough, otherwise we'd have all seen it, okay. I mean, this is amazing. So Esther 5 and verse 1. On the third day is always significant in Scripture. Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace, risking her life as a woman, uninvited, in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her. She had favor in his sight. And he held out the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What's your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." Now that was kind of, you know, a metaphor, up to half, but it meant, you know, she had great favor. We read of another of Xerxes' wives. We're not sure of the whole history of his reign, but he had another wife who was called Amasterus. And she knew that Xerxes had a mistress. And so she was asked by Xerxes on another occasion, "What do you want? You know, up to half my kingdom." And she knew that his mistress had been put in place by her mother-in-law. And she said, "I want the mother-in-law of your mistress executed," a little bit like the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And so so the king says that in a positive way here. And she says, verse 4, "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "if it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I've prepared for them." A simple request, but it would, of course, be a royal banquet. So I'm going to leapfrog to verse 6. They come that evening, and as they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, second time, "Now what's your petition? It will be given you. What's your request? Even up to half my kingdom." And you know what she says? Now, whether this is kind of protocol, you know, she says, "Well, come to a banquet tomorrow night." Whether this is protocol or whether it's she has a word of knowledge because she knows the king's going to have insomnia that night, we don't know. But at the banquet, she says, "Well, come tomorrow night again." So verse 9, "Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate, and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai." And he did a very strange thing. And, you know, tyrants, megalomaniacs, are always insecure. So he goes home, calls all his friends, and he boasts to them about all his wealth and all his magnificence. Isn't that strange? Because he sees Mordecai not bowing down. So he calls them and he boasts about all his wealth and all his magnificence. And so we'll go down to verse 12. "And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she's invited me," little does he know, "along with the king tomorrow. But," this is the big buts, this was his undoing, "but all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting in the king's gates." And verse 14, "His wife Zeresh and his friends said to him, 'Have a gallows built 75 feet high.'" Now that's taller than this church. 75 feet high. So it would be a public spectacle. "And ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it." There would obviously be a trumped up charge. "Then go with the king to the dinner, the banquet in the evening, and be happy." And this suggestion delighted Haman. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. He couldn't wait. He couldn't wait the 12 months when Mordecai would have been killed. He couldn't wait because Mordecai would not bow. Now, another little bit of symbolism coming in here. Haman, obviously, as I've said, is a Satan. He's an Antichrist figure. And the thing about Satan is he cannot tolerate any dissent because he's the ultimate tyrant, he's the ultimate megalomaniac. And so what Mordecai, Haman, I'm mixing them up. I was actually doing a wedding once, and for this couple, I wanted to give them a really good example of a marriage. And so I picked out from the book of Acts, I picked out this wonderful couple, Aquila and Priscilla, because they're spoken of again and again. And I was speaking about Aquila and Priscilla, and I was saying, explaining about Aquila and Priscilla, and saying you need to be like this. And then I did a kind of Freudian slip, and I started talking about Ananias and Sapphira. They're the other couple. So I was telling them to be like Ananias and Sapphira. And the whole congregation was laughing. And I was the last one to realize what was going on. So now I'm doing another kind of Freudian slip. And I'm saying Mordecai when I should be saying Haman. So, none of this satisfies me when I see Mordecai sitting in the king's gate. And you see, this is why Satan is furious when one person does not bow the knee. It doesn't matter, you see. It doesn't matter. You go to a country like Yemen. Everybody's bowing the knee. But there are one or two who aren't. And Satan's satisfaction that everybody else bows the knee is removed. Is removed. So, in where you work, in your office, in your factory, it seems everybody's bowing the knee. But Satan gets no satisfaction because you don't. One person who will not bow the knee spoils everything for him. And that's why at times you come under such pressure. You come under such pressure because you're the one who doesn't bow the knee. And his satisfaction. So don't look around and say, oh my goodness, you know, everybody, there's adultery going on, there's pornography going on, you know, there's divorce going on, there's all this stuff going on. No, look at it the other way around and saying, I am not divorcing my wife, I'm not using pornography, I'm not committing adultery, and I am ruining the satisfaction that Satan has that everybody else is. And that's why you come under pressure. That's why Mordecai is going to come under pressure, because he will not bow the knee, and in not bowing the knee, he ruins Haman's satisfaction that everybody else does bow the knee. And that should give you some... That should give you some, I think it's called moxie. Does that word mean something to you? Because I'm not American, but what does moxie mean? Have I pronounced it properly? What does it mean? Moxie.
Self-satisfaction.
Sorry? That's right, because it was a drink that was developed in the Great Depression. And, you know, things were bad, but you drank moxie. And it was a way of kind of saying, hey, things are bad, but I'm going to stand. I'm going to, you know, and it's kind of anyway. So when everybody's bowing the knee, you just drink some moxie. And our moxie is the Holy Spirit, which we drink. Now, Mordecai, symbolically, of course, is a Christ figure, as well as Esther. And in one very important respect, the gallows, the cross, that was designed for the destruction of Mordecai, symbolizing Christ, was reversed by the resurrection. And Mordecai's deliverance, of course, was a resurrection, like Isaac's deliverance is described as a resurrection. Now, these very gallows, the cross, that were designed to annihilate Mordecai, Christ, became the instruments of Satan's downfall. Okay? Now, I said to Jenny last night that I needed to find a piece of artwork of Joseph in the carpenter's shop. And she said, Joseph in the carpenter's shop? I haven't seen this. And so I need to kind of put this up, Jenny, if you can help me. And this needs to be in the frame, okay? And I don't know how well we're doing here, but we'll try. And this is a picture. This is a picture done by a man called Robert Camplin in 1444. And you know that what they did was something very sensible. And this is, and Joseph is, of course, in a medieval workshop, woodworking shop. And that's what they often did. And just like we will do Romeo and Juliet, and we'll have them all in the modern period. Same plot in the modern period. Just like it's done many times. And so that's what they did. They knew Joseph did not work in a workshop like that, but they made it contemporary. Now, it's full of imagery because here we have an axe and a saw. They're the most prominent instruments, and they're mentioned in Isaiah 15:10. And then he's working on a section of a wine press. He's drilling holes in a piece of wood, and that's how they would do a wine press. And that's picking up as Isaiah 60. I've trodden the wine press alone. But the question is, what is Joseph? Okay, he has one on the bench. I have to go to my... He has one on the bench, and he has one in the window. And the question now, if I've shown you this before, keep quiet. What is he making? What's Joseph making? Jeff, what's he making?
A mousetrap.
He's making a mousetrap. Now, why is Joseph making a mousetrap? You see, this is a biblical picture. Because through the incarnation and through the cross, now it says that Jesus was crucified at the hands of wicked men. And of course, that's what Satan thought was happening. But the very crucifixion, it says in Hebrews that through death, Jesus destroyed he who had the power of death. And so the cross was like a mousetrap. Satan thought he had won. He had got the cheese, but God sprang the trap. Okay, and it was the cross and the resurrection was his downfall. And so this is a wonderful picture, it's full of what the incarnation and the cross and the resurrection was all about. And this metaphor of the mousetrap was very popular in the Middle Ages in speaking about the cross. And of course, that's exactly the symbolism that we have going on here. With Haman, and he will be the enemy will be trapped in the gallows of his own making, just as Satan will be trapped in the cross that he thought was again destroying God's purposes. Now, how are we doing for time? I'm really rattling along this morning, you see. Not told many stories because I want to get to right through the book, and I've only got one more week to go. So, are you up for a little bit more? Okay. If you need another coffee to keep you awake, just get one. But we'll go for another 15 minutes, and that will chapter 7 is. Let's see. I'm going to do some leap. Chapter 6. I'm going to do some bit of leapfrog. That's a little long, but chapter 7 is really short. So I think we might read them both right through, and then I'll make some comments. But now we really get into the fun stuff. So, Esther 6 and verse 1. It just happens that that night the king cannot fall asleep. Now, the Bible is such a wonderful book, isn't it? It just happens that that very night the king can't sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. Now, of course, reading the book of the Chronicles, that's the best way to get to sleep, you know. So, you know, just read me this boring stuff and I'll be asleep in no time. And so he reads the accounts of Mordecai exposing the plot to assassinate him. Verse 3. And so he says to those reading away there while he's lying on the bed, he says, well, what honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this, for exposing this plot some years back that I was going to be assassinated? The king asked. Nothing's been done for him, his attendants answered. The king said, who's in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows he had made for him. Bad timing, Mordecai. Bad timing, okay. And he was so consumed with fury that he even went into the king late at night. And his attendants answered, Haman standing in the court. And the king said, bring him in. And when Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? This is the Hollywood blockbuster, okay? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? And so he says, well, if you really want to honor somebody, give him one of your crowns and give him one of the royal horses that you yourself have read and let him be paraded through the streets with somebody walking ahead saying, this is what's done to the man the king delights to honor. That's Haman's suggestion, okay? Verse 10. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you've suggested for Mordecai the Jew. And if Haman had had a weak heart at that point, he would have had cardiac arrest, okay? And no defibrillator would have done it, the job there. And do for Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. And do not neglect anything you've recommended. It's such a wonderful idea. Such a wonderful idea. Verse 11. So Haman himself got the robe and the horse. And he robed Mordecai. Can you imagine the mortification? He thought he was going to be hanging that man this day. He robed him. And then he led him on horseback through the city streets. And he was proclaiming, he must have struggled to get out the very words. He was proclaiming, this is what's done for the man the king delights to honor. And he could even see in the distance the very gallows he had built to hang this man that day. And afterwards, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief. I don't know what his head looked like, and told Zeresh, his wife. Now, she never had very good advice. And all his friends, everything that had happened to him. Now, they knew it already. I mean, this has spread like wildfire. I mean, he's an idiot to think they don't know it already. He's been doing this all day. And he told his friends everything that had happened to him. And his advisors, notice he was powerful enough to have advisors. And his wife Zeresh got in on the act. who had advised him to build the gallows, now there's a kind of about face. She knows she's not going to be married for much longer. So they say, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. They knew that God was with the Jews. They knew that. You can't stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. That's a nice comfort from his wife, isn't it? You'll surely come to ruin, she says, along with his advisors. And so, verse 14, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet. The king hadn't said anything to Haman yet. I mean, you know, they're reading the writing on the wall, but the king doesn't know anything about this. And so now he does not exactly feel like going to a banquet at this point, but they bring him to the banquet. And we move on to chapter 7. And we have to move on. It's such these run together. They arrive at the banquet. And Esther, the king says, okay, Esther, what's your request? And finally, this is the third time he said to her, what's your request? Finally, in verse 3, the queen answered, if I found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me my life. The king's shocked. My life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. He's astounded. For I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. This is the queen saying, I am destined for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. And then she adds this amazing statement. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet, because no such distress would justify me disturbing the king. Amazing, amazing. Verse 5, King Xerxes said to Queen Esther, who is he? Now Haman at this point is trying to slink out of the room. Who is he? Where's the man who's dared to do such a thing? And Esther says, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. This is amazing. That's right. Boo. That's right. I should have got you to be booing as the Jews do at Purim when this is read. I should have got you booing and cheering all morning. I forgot to do that. Okay. That would have added a bit of spice to the class. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage and left his wine and went out into the palace garden, because he knows now he has to act against a man with enormous power. Haman probably would have eventually plotted to assassinate the king and take the kingdom for himself. He knows this is, I mean, if he has 330 tons of silver he can just give away at a whim. He has advisors. He controls the king's bodyguard. So the king has to act quickly. So he goes out to think how he can preserve even his own life from this powerful tyrant. But Haman, realizing the king had already decided his fate, he just needed to decide how to act, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Then, verse 8, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she's with me in the house? When God decides to bring a man down, he does it in spectacular fashion, okay? And to be found on the couch where any member of the king's harem was sitting was a death sentence in and of itself. We read that the Assyrian kings, you couldn't approach within 7 paces. Nobody could approach within 7 paces of anyone in the queen's harem. And now Esther's on the couch, and the king thinks he's attempting to sexually molest her. The end of verse 8. As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. That could be a euphemism for execution, that they executed him on the spot, and then they hanged his corpse. We don't know. We don't know. It's a curious expression. Either way, if he's not executed on the spot, covering his face is a way of saying, "You're dead, mate." You know, we say that in England. You know, "You're dead, mate. It's over." And then we get to, where am I reading? The end of verse 9, beginning of verse 10. I'm leapfrogging for the sake of time. The king said, okay, one of the eunuchs tells the king, I should have just read it, tells the king of the gallows Haman had built to execute Mordecai. I'll read it. Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, attending the king, said, a gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house. He made it ready for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. Now, this is not the end of the plot, okay? Still the Jews have to be delivered. Why? Why do the Jews have to be delivered? Sorry? Speak up. That's right. The law of the Medes and the Persians could not be revoked. It was a little bit like the Pope, you know, speaking ex cathedra. Okay, it can't be revoked once he spoke ex cathedra. Okay, it is law forever. Okay, and it was a little bit like this with the law of the Medes and the Persians. It couldn't be revoked until the king died. So the king can't revoke it. So there has to be now a little bit more to the story, which will eventuate in the Feast of Purim, which the Jews celebrate to this day. To this day, a great feast of... Now, I am going to close with one wonderful thing. I said to Jenny, I was going to do the book of Esther in one class when I was planning this out. Because before I'd done it in one class, and Esther and Gary ganged up on me. Sorry, Esther. My wife is an Esther. She's an intercessor, okay. So another kind of slip of the tongue. At least I did not quite go as far as what I said to this in this marriage. This was a good. So, Jenny and Gary ganged up on me and said, you can't possibly do the book of Esther in one session. So I could be, and then Esther said, what about all this one? Okay, my wife is an Esther. So Jenny said, what about the whole metaphor? Jenny's saying you can't do this. Now she's saying you can't do this in 2 seconds. Okay, can't do this in 2 seconds. She says you should take all next week doing this. Well, I need to submit to Esther, okay? The king did, so I need to just submit. And, sorry? Oh, yes. And so we got a moment for Bill's story about the angels. Okay. I'll submit to Esther, my wife, and we'll have.